Hayden, and I represent Jason Hurd. The sign is there that the Commonwealth's evidence failed to prove that Hurd participated in the robbery of Ray Ketty or the attempted carjacking of Ketty's car or agreed with anyone to commit a robbery. The victim acknowledged that he could not identify Hurd as one of the robbers, and Hurd plainly wasn't the person who struggled with Ketty over the car keys.
It shows that he's present,
but it doesn't show that he actually did anything or showed the criminal intent to participate in the robbery.
We have three people, and the victim can't identify who played which role. And we know two of the three individuals played a role in what occurred.
Right.
The third person, whoever that was, whether it's your client or someone else, was clearly present. And then the open question is, is there evidence of their involvement in the light most favorable of the Commonwealth that suggests they were more than just present? Do you agree that that's basically what this comes down to?
Yes. And so all we have here is evidence that he was present and that there was subsequent flight, as I cited in the Moyne case.
I want to make sure we're on the same page on it. We're talking about principal in the second degree as to the attempted carjacking and principal in the first degree as to conspiracy, correct?
I guess that would be correct.
Okay. So in terms of, let's take the conspiracy first. That's just a plan to commit a crime. And here, I guess that would be shown by the circumstantial evidence here, in light of the state of the Commonwealth, that your client certainly was with the individuals, walked, as Mr. Allen just pointed out, walked towards the vehicles, has admitted that he actually planned to commit crimes similar to this, not carjacking, but taking things out of cars. This car just happened to be occupied at the time. And then he fled with the other two individuals. So why is it that circumstantial evidence that he was part of the plan that the other two individuals were engaged in?
This is a lot like the case of McMarsh versus Commonwealth 276 Virginia 500. That was a case where McMarsh was present also, but the Virginia Supreme Court ruled that there was just circumstantial evidence that he was present for the purpose of committing an assault and battery. I'm sorry? In that case, they noted that McMarsh's presence, where they were relying wholly on circumstantial evidence to infer an agreement to conspiracy, because the evidence offered against McMarsh in the McMarsh case was wholly circumstantial, such evidence must exclude all reasonable conclusions inconsistent with that of guilt. The circumstantial evidence in that case was insufficient to prove Marsh shared the criminal had agreed in that case.
Here what we have, though, is the agreement we have all three of the individuals indicating that there was some So why isn't there a reasonable inference to be drawn that they're now approaching an occupied vehicle, that the intent was in fact either robbed or take something from
that person? Normally there has to be, a principal in the second degree, there has to be some evidence that he did something in furtherance of the crime or shared the criminal intent. That's completely absent here. So we set aside... No proof from testimony of the other witnesses or on the part of the victim saying that the defendant did anything other than be present.
He expressed his criminal intent. He said, I was there to run cars. I was there to basically steal things out of cars.
And so the Commonwealth says that he doesn't have to share criminal intent if they're acting in concert of action for an unlawful action. The resulting crime, whether the crime was originally contemplated or not, is a natural and probable consequence of the intended wrongful act. So you cite cases, for example, persons go to commit an armed bank robbery. They're all armed, and then someone ends up getting killed unexpectedly or not one of the original. That's a natural and probable consequence of an armed robbery of a bank. But here, running through cars, is it a natural and probable consequence of just the decision to steal from cars that there's going to be a violent robbery occurs?
Except for this particular case, the car's occupied, correct?
That's correct. This case is a lot like, as in the McMorris case, persons there assembled for an unlawful purpose too, to commit an assault and battery, and then incidentally somebody else steals an item unbeknownst to McMorris, the defendant in that case, and the Supreme Court reversed his convictions in that case, it wasn't a natural and probable consequence of an assault that a robbery was going to occur. Likewise, they cited in the McMorris case, they cited an 1885 case of the Virginia Supreme Court, Kemp versus Commonwealth, 80 Virginia 443, where it was, they cited fact, that case was of persons who were poachers. They were assembled for the purpose of poaching. And in that case, someone, one of the poachers ends up robbing somebody, beating him, leaving him senseless, and the Supreme Court ruled that if one of them returns and steals the money, and that person may be convicted of robbery, but it's not a natural and probable consequence of the mere decision to run through cars that somebody's going to be robbed and beaten or carjacked. It's not enough to say they shared a criminal purpose. And that's clearly the holding of the Kemp case and the McMorris case that I have cited. And if this was a situation where they were planning to do robberies and then somebody gets some violent action occurs, that is a natural and probable, but it's not a natural and probable consequence of petty larceny or breaking in, running through cars. That was the testimony, the sole testimony of their purpose in going to the parking lot of this place. And so the reasonable evidence, the hypothesis of innocence that's not excluded by the Commonwealth's evidence, is that Zion Johnson, the person who admitted he committed the robbery, decided on his own to commit it robbery. He said Hurd wasn't involved, that he tries to wrest the keys from the person. A second person gets into the car from the passenger side in the back seat and hits him in the back of the head. He didn't see who that was, but probably that was Takari Payne, because Takari Payne minutes afterwards was found in possession of Ketty's phone. But there was absolutely zero evidence to suggest that the defendant heard it act as a lookout, or that he countenanced or encouraged or egged him on in any way. He's just present, and he subsequently flees. And Morton Clace is clearly in point, clearly in controlling in this case, that you have to, mere presence at the scene of crime and subsequent flight is insufficient to show a shared common intent that he participated in the crime. And I would also note the Commonwealth tries to argue that, well, this is concert of action, and so if it's concert of action, you don't have to show intent at all. A lack of intent cannot be used as defense where there's concert of action and the resulting crime was a natural and probable consequence of the intended wrongful act. The Hampton case, Commonwealth versus Commonwealth case of this court did a very nice analysis. It's 32 Virginia App 644, 2000 case of this court, where this court noted that because presence without disapproving or opposing the crime the commission of a crime in connection with other circumstances is evidence that a defendant lent his countenance in approval to a crime, we must determine whether other circumstances were present in addition to the defendant's failure to approve or to disapprove or oppose the actions of the perpetrator. And they cited the cases of Foster versus Commonwealth that was cited in the brief of the AG and Puglisi versus Commonwealth. In those cases, there were other circumstances present. For example, in Foster, the defendant in that case lived in a house of prostitution, knowing it to be such, and he shares in the earnings from the prostitutes, contributes to the maintenance of the establishment. It was reasonable to assume that he was acting in concert of action with the others. And Puglisi, cited by the AG, in that case, a person is shot and killed inside a van, robbed in a van, or the second person's present in a van. He says, well, we were planning on stealing, but we didn't plan on robbing and killing the person, but that there were other circumstances present. For one, he actually shares in disposing of the body. He shares in the proceeds. Thank you. He shares in the proceeds of the robbery, and so those other circumstances supported the notion that he lent his support to the murder and robbery that occurred. But they cited also, they said clearly in Foster and Puglisi, other circumstances were present in addition to the defendant simply being present and not opposing the act. But in the case of Moreland, and in the case of the Hampton case, those other circumstances were not present. There was no evidence in this case that the defendant participated in the theft, in the robbery, or aided or abetted by inciting, encouraging, advising, or assisting. No evidence showed he acted as a lookout. No evidence showed he shared criminal intent. This is exactly on point with the evidence in the Hampton case and the McMorris case. There is zero evidence that the reasonable hypothesis, not excluded by the evidence, is that when they go over there to run through cars, that Zion Johnson and Shakari Payne are willing to commit the robbery and carjacking on their own while Heard hangs back and does not participate. That's the reasonable, and there's zero evidence to prove otherwise. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Chris Obenchain here on behalf of the Commonwealth. We're asking the Court to affirm all three of the convictions here for Mr. Heard on the basis that the evidence was sufficient for the fact finder to...
Mr. Obenchain, not to interrupt you so early, if you want to just speak to Mr. Hayden's argument in reference to the conspiracy.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll address the conspiracy charge. Primarily since it seems that that's what the Court is interested in here. First of all, I would note that McMorris is not a conspiracy case. It's a robbery case. I would just note that for the Court. But I would also point out that I think it was mentioned in Mr. Hayden's argument that criminal act usually requires an overt act. I would note that conspiracy is different. Conspiracy doesn't require an overt act. Conspiracy only requires an agreement between two or more people to achieve some criminal objective. And that's what we have here. The evidence was plainly sufficient for the jury to infer from the conduct. And again, I mean, we have this as a case where we don't have an explicit plan necessarily. This Court in Charity noted that a explicit verbal agreement is not required for conspiracy, that conspiracy can be inferred from conduct as well.
Mr. Overshin, let me follow up on Judge Mavo's question. And I'm not sure I know the answer to this off the top of my head, but I'd be interested in your take on it. If you have a plan, in other words, let's assume these three individuals were all planning to run cars, in other words, break into cars and take whatever, valuable items they could find. If that was the plan, but as a result one of these cars is occupied and it results in one of them by force attempting to take the keys or whatever, and the net result is either an attempted robbery or in this case an attempted carjacking, but that wasn't the original plan, Does the conspiracy morph by virtue of one of the individuals going beyond the original plan, or is the original plan still basically a conspiracy to commit grand larceny or larceny of some sort, as opposed to carjacking? It seems to me, at least based on what I learned in law school 100 years ago, that you know whatever the plan is frames whatever the crime, the substantive crime is. Not, and then if another crime, a more serious crime occurs, well, that may net you liability as a principal or an accessory to that crime, but it doesn't necessarily alter what the conspiracy originally was, does it?
Well, Your Honor, I think, first of all, I would note, I do think the evidence is sufficient that the jury could find that the carjacking was encompassed by the original plan, and that's a common law's, I want to make it clear that that's the common law's position. But to answer the specific hypothetical, that even if we believe that the original plan only encompassed stealing from cars, my argument would be that he can still be found liable for a conspiracy to commit carjacking if he assented to that amendment to the conspiracy. And that's where I would again point to his conduct as a whole, the totality of the circumstances, his conduct as a whole. The three of them are there in the parking lot, they're walking around, they're looking in cars, they're approaching people in cars, as is shown by the video. They approached a different group of people before they approached Mr. Ketty's car. And then what occurs is when the attack on Mr. Ketty occurs, I wouldn't concede that we know that Mr. Hurd wasn't one of the two people that was involved in the actual carjacking itself. We don't know that. I think
Mr. Queen's point is the fact that the other co-defendant is found with the cell phone on his person, and so therefore I think he's saying by reasonable deduction, we don't have anything that links.
But what we do have is first of all, the testimony from Mr. Ketty, which is confirmed by the video evidence, that the three of them approached his car together. Then what occurred is he's attacked. One person opens the front door, tries to take his keys. A second person comes in the back, hits him in the head. And then Mr. Ketty testifies that he blows the horn, and the three of them run off together. I think that's also confirmed by Johnson's testimony, that the three of them fled together.
And back to the conspiracy in reference to Judge Humphrey's question, what evidence would there be, because you definitely have the discussion they've had about running the cars, is there anything that morphs this into carjacking and robbery? Maybe better asked, is the fact that they're approaching an occupied car, does that change anything in terms of the agreement? Is it impactful in any way as opposed to going to an unoccupied car?
I think it is here. I mean, I think the facts of this case show that, first of all, Mr. Ketty's testimony was they approached him first and asked him for money, and then they approached him again, and that's when the carjacking occurred. So the fact that they were approaching a car, and the car had just driven past, had just parked, they knew it was occupied. It was, I think that's a reasonable inference the jury could draw, is that they were aware this car was occupied. It wasn't a surprise. He wasn't lying in the back seat or something like that. But they were aware that this was an occupied car. I think the reasonable inference from that the three of them approached the car together, they fled together when he hit the horn, they were seen walking casually down the street together, again by police, before police activated their lights, and then they fled. All of those circumstances indicate that Mr. Hurd was an active participant in what was going on here. And I think, again, I think the evidence is sufficient for the jury to conclude, based on the totality of the circumstances, that stealing cars was encompassed as part of their original plan, that they didn't necessarily have to believe self-serving statement that they were just stealing from cars. I think obviously if they had opened a car and somebody had left their keys there, that taking the car, probably would be encompassed in that, in their criminal intent. And I think under the case law, that criminal intent was sufficient for them to be convicted of, for Mr. Hurd to be convicted of the conspiracy to commit carjacking, either, you know, by the jury's reasonable inference that the carjacking was encompassed in their original plan, or that it was an amendment to the plan that he assented to and continued to participate in that conspiracy. He didn't run away. He didn't, you know, flee and say, hey, this isn't what I signed up for or anything like that. There was none of that evidence. He approached the car that he knew was occupied. The carjacking occurred. He apparently, in the light most favorable to him, you know, at the very least, he stood there while the other two were conducting this carjacking.
Wasn't there some testimony, correct me if I'm wrong, was it Johnson told him to stand in front of the vehicle while the robbery was going down?
I believe that Johnson's testimony, he told the other two to go ask him for money or stand by the car, something to that effect. I think that's correct. And I think his testimony was they asked him, what are you going to do? And I think that kind of shows that there was at least some conversation between them before that was not in Mr. Keddie's presence, but before this carjacking actually occurred. There was some sort of conversation between the three of them. I think based on the circumstances, based on their conduct, the conduct of all three of them during this event, the jury could reasonably conclude that, again, that either this was part of the original plan or that this was an amendment to the plan that was agreed on by all three parties and then carried out, and then they run off and they leave and they're walking down the street together when they're seen by the police a few minutes later. And then they flee and he hides and they have to find him. So all of those circumstances taken as a whole, I think were sufficient to support the jury's conclusion that this was part of the conspiracy. I think as far as the other two offenses go, he was liable under a concert of action theory of the case. I would point out that it was never contested. It was never contested in the motions to strike that these crimes weren't a natural and probable consequence of their criminal intent. It was only argued that there was never any agreement. That was the basis of the motion to strike, was that there was never any agreement. And I think certainly the statement by Hurd to police, the statement that Johnson also made that they were there with a criminal intent, and then their actions as a whole support the fact that they had a shared criminal intent, and that these actions were a natural and probable consequence of their reason for being in the Embassy Suites parking lot that morning. And so for those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm these convictions. Unless there are any further questions, the court will rest on our brief. Thank you.
Mr. Hayden?
There's no direct evidence that he entered into a conspiracy. They only have circumstantial evidence that he was present and then afterwards fled. And the case law is clear that the evidence is wholly circumstantial, the evidence must exclude reasonable conclusions inconsistent with that of guilt, and a reasonable hypothesis is that he elected not to participate. He did not agree. He hung back. He did not. The evidence was that from Kenny was he saw three persons approaching, but only two participated in the robbery. And there's zero evidence of any assent or any sort of a participation on the part of the defendant. We just can't simply presume that he from the circumstantial evidence that he entered into an agreement. There is a reasonable hypothesis here, not excluded. It's not enough that they shared a criminal intent to go out and run through cars. And as in the McMorris case, there was a shared criminal intent of the group to commit assault and battery. If there was not a shared intent to commit robbery, and it was not a reasonable probable consequence of the assault that there was going to be a robbery by one of the persons. Same way in the Kemp case from 1885. Although the poachers assembled for an unlawful purpose to steal, it's like persons saying going to the Walmart to steal, and then one of them commits a robbery out in the parking lot, doesn't make them all responsible for robbery that they shared a criminal intent to go to the Walmart to steal. That's not enough. There has to be something to show that he shares criminal intent, or they had a concert of action to commit robbery in the beginning. There's zero evidence of concert of action to commit robbery or carjacking. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Hayden. We'll come down to brief counsel and pick up the next case.